I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are beginning our second lecture on the Platonic dialogue Gorgias, and we're going to be talking about the conversation between Socrates and the sophist named Polus. If you are interested in asking questions or in supporting Countercurrents, just with a donation, my recommendation is to look at the bottom of the screen and go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. You can also send me DLive tokens, and you can send tips through Odyssey as well. We very much appreciate it. I would like to recapitulate a bit some of the things that we looked at in the first session. In the first session, we looked at Socrates' conversation with Gorgias. Gorgias is an elderly and respectable gentleman. He was a great teacher of rhetoric. He was one of the great sophists of ancient Greece. And he was in Athens as an ambassador. And apparently, Socrates has arrived after he's given one of his stunt speeches, one of his display speeches. And during the time when he was doing one of his Q&A sessions, and Gorgias was the inventor of the Q&A, the inventor of the ask me anything. And he asks Gorgias what his techne is. It's translated here as craft. I also like to use art. Art not in the sense of fine arts, although it would include the fine arts, but art in the sense of some kind of craft or technique that changes the world. Techne is about changing things. It's about altering circumstances. Gorgias says that he is the practitioner and the teacher of a techne called rhetoric. And Socrates wants to know, well, what is rhetoric about? It takes a while to get Gorgias to get specific. Gorgias speaks indirectly about what rhetoric is about. He says, well, it produces the greatest things. Yes, okay, but what? It deals with speeches. Okay, every art has speeches connected to it. It deals entirely in speeches. Well, that's true of some arts as well. It's true of, say, geometry, right? So finally, Socrates gets Gorgias to say what rhetoric produces, what it's about. It produces persuasion about certain things, and through it, it produces the greatest of human goods, he says, and those are freedom for oneself and rule over others. And then he goes on to say that if you have this technical skill, the skill of rhetoric, and you use it in political gatherings, in legislative assemblies, in council meetings, in trials, you can gain supreme power in a society. And therefore, rhetoric is the supreme art that allows you access to the levers of power by which you can regulate all the other arts in a society. So rhetoric is what some people have called an architectonic art, a master art, the master of all the arts. And Socrates finds this to be a dangerous and frightening thing. One of the reasons why it's dangerous and frightening is that it has its own knowledge attached to it. It's its own set of skills, its own theory attached to it, but it also has a peculiar power to make other arts more effective, even though the rhetorician knows nothing about them. Even though a rhetorician might know nothing about medicine, nothing about pharmacy, nothing about shipbuilding or chariot building or shoemaking, he can still make these artisans more effective, at least in front of the ignorant, which is the majority of people in any given case. The majority of people don't know about shoemaking. They don't know about medicine. They don't know about pharmacy. But in front of those people, the rhetorician is more persuasive than the actual artisan who knows, which I think is very interesting. And Socrates thinks it's quite alarming, actually. Shouldn't knowledge be more important than, if you will, spin? Because that's what rhetoricians do. They just put spins on things. So Gorgias says, oh, you don't know the half of it, Socrates. The power of rhetoric encompasses all and it subordinates everything to it. It encompasses all because it gives one access to supreme power in a society, which allows you to regulate all the other arts, regulate the sciences, regulate all the human activities, all the goods produced by society. So it gives you supreme power. It's all encompassing. It subordinates all to it. And also it can make everything more effective. And the reason why Socrates is alarmed by this, more so than by any other art, is that rhetoric is not just rhetoric. It's not just the study of speeches. It's a kind of political philosophy or political ideology. And it is a simulacrum. It is a close but no cigar, almost copy of what philosophy is supposed to do. Because like rhetoric, philosophy is primarily practical. It's an art. It's a techne. In some sense, although Socrates wants to distinguish it from all the other technae, but it's practical in its aim. It changes things. And it is all-encompassing. It's about all things. Wisdom, which philosophy pursues, deals with all things. In some sense, it deals with the whole. And also, wisdom is concerned with making things more effective. In what sense? Well, wisdom is concerned with the application of knowledge, the application of skills, the use of the various goods that society and fortune make possible. And so wisdom is about the right use of all things. The great difference between philosophy, which pursues wisdom, and rhetoric, which pursues supreme power, is that philosophy is by its very nature always oriented towards the good. It's always oriented towards the right. This is how it allows us to make right use of the various things that are available to us, the various skills we have, the various bodies of knowledge we possess, the various goods that fortune has delivered us, and so forth. Whereas Gorgias is quick to state that although rhetoric gives you supreme, all-encompassing, and all-subordinating and effectuating power, it is a morally neutral technique. And that means that teachers like Gorgias cannot be held responsible for the bad uses that people might put it to. So what Gorgias is really talking about is rule by technique, rule by experts, all-encompassing and all-subordinating power that is morally neutral. And the more power it accumulates, it still doesn't make itself any more morally coherent. It needs something else to guide it toward the good. And yet it seems to think that it's supreme. It's superior to everything else. There's a kind of blindness here combined with extreme power. Now, if a shoemaker is unethical or clumsy, ethically clumsy, what's the worst thing that can happen, right? But if a techne gives you supreme power over society, and yet in and of itself, it doesn't have a clue about the good, it is not capable of producing well-being for ruler and ruled alike. It's simply oblivious to that. And what happens then? What kind of values govern such a society? Well, we start getting a clue in the conversation with Polus, and we even get a clearer picture in the conversation with Callicles. The values that rule a society subordinated by techne, basically, are basically just the values of more, more, more. One of the ways of understanding the role of wisdom in life is that wisdom sets limits. Wisdom says enough is enough. And that's how you can use things. That's part of this idea of right use. Right use includes setting boundaries. One of the most important virtues for the Greeks was temperance. What does temperance do? Well, it says no. It sets limits to the satisfaction of your desires. It allows you to contain yourself, right? Without temperance, what happens? Well, you have what the Greeks call planexia, which just means wanting more and more and more and more. Endless greed, unlimited acquisition. That sounds like the sort of society we live in today. And if unlimited acquisitiveness causes crises, well, that's simply another technical problem that we can call upon experts to solve. And so you have a situation where people are driven by desire without limit into clashes with reality, clashes with other people. And the people who run society simply regard these problems as more technical problems to manage. And so consequently, we're just depending on luck. We're depending on luck for survival. The technocratic society is a car without brakes, because it takes wisdom to say enough and tap on the brakes. And we don't have that today. And Socrates saw that this was a problem even more than 2,400 years ago. So this is why the conversation with Gorgias is so relevant, and the continuing conversations in this dialogue with Polus and Callicles. This is an ancient history. This is the world we live in today. And it allows us to zero in on what's missing in our world today. What's missing in our world today is a sense of limits, a sense of wisdom, a sense of the difference between technical knowledge and wisdom. Again, if you don't really understand that there is a distinction between the ability to do things and the ability to make right use of your knowledge, you're going to be in a world without limits. And the only limits that you will basically have are limits imposed upon you by reality as it snaps back at you, or the crises that are created by your basically unlimited pursuit of whatever. And what you'll do with these crises is just treat them as technological problems, which is not the right solution. That's the world we live in today. And I think it's adumbrated, it's foreshadowed here in the Gorgias. So let's move forward and talk a bit about the dialogue with Polus now. What happens with the conversation with Gorgias is Socrates finds Gorgias contradicting himself. Gorgias says, "Hey, don't blame me. My hands are clean. I just teach a technical skill. And if other people misuse it, that's on them. That's not on me. I shouldn't be persecuted." He has been persecuted in other cities because of the stuff that his students got up to. And so he wants to maintain the moral neutrality of his techne rhetoric. But then once he lays out just how awe-inspiring its powers are, he says, "Of course, Socrates, you should never use it for bad purposes," right? He indicates that he's very, very concerned with morality, or at least he's paying lip service to it. And Socrates pursues that. He says, "Well, Gorgias, you say that they're going to be speaking the language of justice and injustice when they go into political gatherings to persuade people in pursuit of power. So do your students know what justice is? Do they know what the right thing is?" And Gorgias says, "Well, Socrates, if they don't know it when they come to me, they'll pick it up as they go along. And then Socrates basically says, well, look, isn't it the case that a man who knows what the just is a just man? Now, Socrates is depending on an assumption here that you can question, but it's definitely one of his philosophical assumptions, which is to know the good is to do it. If you know what the right thing is, you'll do it. And if you think you know what the right thing is and you don't do it, Socrates is going to say, well, you don't really know it in some sense. Interestingly enough, Aristotle talks about a problem with this. People say, well, what about weakness of the will, right? What if it's the case that people know the right thing to do, but they just don't do it because they're weak? And even Aristotle, in the end, argues that weakness of the will is kind of a momentary form of non-knowing. And so in the end, Socrates' claim that if you know what's good, you will do it, is maintained even by Aristotle, who's criticizing it or looking at a criticism of it. And so if you believe that knowing justice makes you a just man, and if you, Gorgias, claim that all the people who learn the art of rhetoric from you will come out of their education knowing what justice is if they didn't know it already, then how is it even possible for rhetoricians to behave unjustly? At that point, he's finding a contradiction in the position of Gorgias, because Gorgias said, well, it's morally neutral, yet if you receive an education in rhetoric, you will know the just, and so you won't behave unjustly. So he's sort of saying that maybe rhetoric isn't the same as knowledge of the good, but it's going to come bundled with it always, and so you don't have to worry about rhetoricians misbehaving. Socrates thinks he's contradicting himself. At this point, Polus comes in, and Polus's basic argument is that Socrates is depending on Gorgias's reluctance to admit that morality, justice, really isn't necessarily a part of what's going on with sophistry. It really is morally neutral as a technique, but beyond that, a lot of the people who are attracted to it aren't interested in justice at all. They're interested in getting ahead, and they have a great deal of contempt, oftentimes, for any moral notions whatsoever, which they think are merely conventional. And so the people who flocked to the sophists wanted to be tyrants, basically. They wanted to gratify themselves regardless of justice. They either didn't know about justice or didn't care about justice, and they certainly weren't trying to pick it up along the way when they were studying with Gorgias. But Gorgias won't admit to that. He's too ashamed to admit to that. And so he's gotten himself contradicted. And Polus thinks this is bad taste. It's bad taste only in a kind of cynical, we're all men of the world here attitude, which basically says that a certain amount of cynicism about human behavior is baseline, it's normal, and that people who go around demanding that people say, never cheat on their wives or never get drunk, well, that's sort of a tasteless form of hypocrisy, right? And he's basically accusing Socrates of this tasteless form of hypocrisy, basically accusing somebody of being unjust. Of course, nobody really cares all that much about justice, right? And it's bad taste to accuse somebody of being unjust and put them on the spot so they have to fake it. That's the gist of Polus's complaint. So Polus is a different breed than Gorgias. He is a student of Gorgias. He's a younger man. And he's not so concerned with pieties, I guess you can say, public pieties about justice. He's not so concerned with what people in society at large consider to be shameful or shameless behavior. We see that Gorgias is very concerned about these things. He's concerned about his audience. He's concerned to be polite to his audience, not to overburden them with excessive Q&As, things like that. Gorgias is a gentleman. And to be a gentleman, in part, is to be concerned with what's shameful. And it's to be a little bit high-minded and a little bit idealistic and certainly unwilling to admit that one is dealing with people who are unconcerned with justice, or certainly unwilling to admit that he's teaching people how to do bad things. Maybe on some level, he really believes that. Maybe on some level, he really believes that it's not his responsibility. These are all well-meaning people who are showing up here. Obviously, when you get to the speech of Callicles, which is the last three sessions of this class, and it's the bulk of the dialogue, we're going to see that Callicles is no gentleman, and that it cannot have escaped Gorgias, unless he's just sort of a goofy old guy, that he's surrounded by people who are learning how to be human predators with the art of rhetoric. So let's move forward. There are three main philosophical points in the conversation between Socrates and Polus. And the first thing is laying out sort of an overview of where Socrates thinks rhetoric fits in with politics. Implicitly, what Gorgias does is he identifies the art of rhetoric with the political, because he says that the art of rhetoric is what allows you to seize control of political power, seize control of the levers of power. Therefore, rhetoric is political science, if you will. And Socrates wants to argue, no, it's not. And so he lays out this rather complicated schematic. And the best way of dealing with this complicated schematic is to make a chart. So I have made a chart, and we are going to run through this chart here. I hope you can enlarge it on your screens if need be. Socrates basically says, let's create a chart, Polus, and I'll show you where your art of rhetoric fits in. First of all, he says it's not an art, which is shocking to Gorgias and Polus. And so there's an important distinction here between a techne and what he calls a knack. Now, the Greek word for knack is empiria, from which we get the word empirical, having to do with experience. And in more archaic forms of English, the word empiric referred to a quack doctor, a charlatan, a bumbler. And what these quack doctors did is they were doctors based on experience and trial and error, but they didn't have science attached to their doctoring skills. And they didn't have a way of articulating what they were doing. And therefore, one of the characteristics of empirics is they're lousy teachers. The only thing an empiric can do to teach another person is to say, just imitate me and practice, practice, practice. Whereas a true art, a true master of an art, not only has the technical skills, the practical skills that the empirics have based on experience, because you can't have art without actually practicing. It's not pure theory, right? You actually have to do stuff. To have the art of rhetoric, you've got to make speeches. You can't just talk about it. You've got to make speeches. So the master, though, has taken a step back from the practices, and he's distilled out some general principles and some rules of thumb. He can speak intelligently about what he's doing, not just do it, but take a step back from it and speak about it, theorize about it. And because he can speak intelligently about what he's doing, it's possible for him to be a teacher of his art. And so the main distinction here is being techne proper, which has both what you can call intelligent speeches, or logoi in the Greek, attached to it, and empyreia, meaning knacks, actual practices that you've, actually things you've learned by practice, right? You can't learn how to swim by reading a treatise on swimming. You have to get in the pool and move your arms and legs. You got to thrash around a bit. And that's empyreia. It's the actual doing of stuff. And the true artist has both a logos and experience, whereas the mere empiric only has experience. And Socrates says, I don't think that oratory belongs in the category of a true techne. It's just a knack, he says. Okay, and so that's the important first distinction. Now, let's look at this chart at this point. Socrates is always talking about the soul and the body. He's always making analogies between the soul and the body. So let's say there's a soul and a body. And you can talk about what produces well-being in the body and well-being in the soul. Basically, for Socrates, moral philosophy deals with the health of the soul, just like medicine and healthy living deals with the health of the body. Okay, so let's look at the first column. The first column is the soul and the body. The second column at the top begins well-being, which means real fitness. You can talk about well-being of the soul and well-being of the body. What produces well-being in the body? Well, there's not one word for it, but you can call it health production and restoration. These produce physical well-being, and he divides them into two categories: gymnastics, which means diet, exercise, healthy living, things that produce good health, and then medicine, which restores good health, or it should say, restores good health, overcomes bad health. What produces health or fitness in the soul? Well, Socrates says it's politics, which is interesting. Politics should produce health of the soul. Statecraft is soulcraft. Politics should produce virtue for the ancient Greeks. This just causes liberals of the left and the right to freak out. The very idea that they can try and force morality down our throats, right? The whole purpose of politics for Plato, Aristotle, Socrates is to make people more virtuous. Now, it's not the sole source of virtue. There are certain things that you can't get out of politics. Philosophers understand that. But as far as we're concerned here, we're talking about politics. Politics is certainly the bedrock of it. Politics produces spiritual well-being. How does it produce spiritual well-being? Through legislation, which builds up spiritual health, and through justice, which basically means punishment, which purges spiritual sickness. So legislation is, if you will, the gymnastics of the soul. Legislation is what, just as gymnastics and healthy living make the body healthy, so legislation makes the soul healthy. Justice, punishment, is the medicine of the soul. Just as medicine restores good health, purges bad health, so justice purges spiritual sickness and restores spiritual health. Now, what kind of stuff can do that? Obviously, what kind of things can produce well-being? Well, Socrates wants to say, he uses a number of terms to describe this process. Well-being, real fitness, is produced by friendship, which is opposed to flattery in the next column over. I don't think that's really a good term. I think edification might be a better term. Building up. There are certain things that you can do to edify people, both spiritually and physically. You can build them up spiritually and physically. That is aided by techne, which means knack plus logos, and it's guided by the good. Now, Let's look at the third column. The third column is about the counterfeit of well-being, which is merely feeling good, which is mere apparent fitness. It's counterfeit well-being, counterfeit politics, and counterfeit health. Counterfeit health, let's go to the bottom. Counterfeit health, again, is the appearance of physical well-being. And he says there are two things that produce counterfeit health. He calls one cosmetics, which creates the appearance of good health. And that, of course, would be makeup. But you could also talk about certain cosmetic things like dressing in a certain way, or you could talk about cosmetic surgery, an abomination that didn't exist at the time. You could talk about, say, tanning. You have an unhealthy complexion because you're unhealthy. So you go and lie in a tanning bed to give you the simulacrum of a healthy complexion, things like that. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about fake ways of producing the appearance of good health. And when he talks about fake ways, the sort of the equivalent of medicine, he talks about, of all things, pastry chefs. I call it confectionery. And that's just one example, really, of anything that creates the feeling of good health, usually while creating bad health, right? Things that make you feel good. Well, what are some of the things that make you feel good that aren't necessarily good for you? Well, sugar, alcohol, high carb meals, that kind of stuff. Of course, all the whole range of drugs that make you feel good, but they often have negative health consequences. So these are counterfeits of health. If you wake up in the morning and you're hungover, you could take some medicine, or better yet, stop drinking in excess to restore your good health. You could do the medical route, or you could take something that makes you feel better, but doesn't really deal with the underlying problem. Maybe a little of the hair of the dog that bit you, right? So counterfeiting health in the body has its equivalence in the soul. And again, if politics produces health in the soul, then counterfeit politics would be producing spiritual corruption, fake health, if you will, in the soul. And he divides this into two categories. And this is somewhat artificial, this division, but it's trying to create an analogy with legislation and justice. So he says sophistry, which is exercised in legislatures, produces unjust legislation. And oratory in law courts produces unjust punishments. And so you can say that sophistry is the cosmetics of the soul, or oratory is the confectionery of the soul. Oratory creates a fake sense of health, fake sense of justice in a society by creating unjust punishments. Now, what would an example of that be? Well, all the fake moral outrage being expressed, say, about poor George Floyd. That's fake moral outrage, virtue signaling that produces evil rather than justice. The French are getting their fill of that right now. So that's an example of that. Oratory in law courts producing unjust punishments would be things like scapegoating people for being the bearers of bad news. So that statesmen who have messed things up, they just blame their enemies. They say, no, the problem is not that I have led our country into war. The problem, the real problem, is that you're talking about it and getting people upset. And we're going to stop you. We're going to put you on trial for sedition. We're going to lock you up, or we're going to take away your social media platform or whatever. Okay. That's the sense in which he talks about oratory. It's punishment meted out unjustly, but it always masks itself as justice. And it makes society a worse place. So what are examples of sophistry? Well, basically any unjust legislation, any corrupt legislation that masks itself in virtue and make society a worse place is what he calls sophistry. So that's concretely what Socrates is talking about. Now, below the chart, we have some analogies here. Cosmetics is to gymnastics as confectionery is to medicine, is one of them. So cosmetics, meaning the production of the fake appearance of health, is to gymnastics the production of real health, as confectionery, namely the creation of fake feelings of health, you know, fake purgations of sickness, is to medicine, which really purges sickness. Okay. Sophistry is to legislation as oratory is to justice. Sophistry, again, is fake legislation that produces injustice, just as oratory is fake punishment, if you will, that produces injustice. So to say confectionery is to medicine as oratory is to justice, again, confectionery, it creates the feeling of good health, whereas medicine actually creates good health, restores good health. Oratory creates the feeling that you have done justice, whereas justice actually purges evil in the soul. Another analogy he uses in here is cosmetics is to gymnastics as sophistry is to education. Cosmetics, again, creates the appearance of good health, whereas gymnastics creates real good health. Sophistry produces fake legislation that corrupts society, whereas real legislation actually improves people's souls. Another way you can put it, these relations, is that legislation is the gymnastics of the soul, or gymnastics is the legislation of the body. Medicine is the justice of the body. Justice is the medicine of the soul. Confectionery is the oratory of the body. Oratory is the confectionery of the soul. Cosmetics is the sophistry of the body. Sophistry is the cosmetics of the soul. Now, once this is all laid out, and it's laid out at great length, I can just envision wisps of steam escaping from Polus's ears, and Gorgias, I think, is not particularly pleased with this. But this is how Socrates places what they do. It's not politics. It's not real politics. It's fake, corruptive politics that the sophists are preaching and equipping people for. And so this is a beautiful chart because it gives you a sense of what's at stake. Let's talk a little bit about the very top column, the very top box on the third column. So producing good feeling, the counterfeit of fitness. Socrates says it's produced by flattery. The Greek is kolakeia. It's a weird word. Pandering might be the best term for it, the best translation of it. And just as edification means building up, pandering means stooping down. Pandering means flattering people's worst traits, whereas edification means saying, no, I'm not going to flatter your worst traits. I'm going to appeal to the better angels of your nature, and I'm going to try and make you a better person. All bad politics involves pandering. By pandering to people's lower natures and prurient interests and vices, it makes people worse. So counterfeit politics, sophistry and oratory are pandering that make people worse. Cosmetics and confectionery are pandering that makes people worse. This process is aided by the knack of rhetoric and other knacks. And he also talks about how these people, they don't have really have knowledge or logos, but they're good at guesswork. And they're also good at convincing people without knowledge. Well, how do you convince people of something important if you don't know anything about it and they don't know anything about it? Well, you got to be good at schmoozing. You got to be good at puffery. You've got to be shameless. And so the orators who pander and corrupt society are schmoozers and they're brazen schmoozers, and they are liars, basically. And they're contemptuous of knowledge, but they're often shrewd at guessing. And if they guess wrongly, well, they're often very shrewd at wriggling out of any negative consequences and leaving somebody else with the bill. It's a very vivid picture of a society in chaos ruled by corrupt people, a society that constantly appeals to the worst traits of human nature rather than the best traits of human nature. I just think it's a very, very powerful image. All right, let's move forward. So once Socrates has laid out this overview of how he differentiates true political science from sophistry, then he goes into a discussion of power and freedom. And this is extremely important and rather profound. This is the beginning of endless debates in political philosophy. It's right here, folks. So again, recall that Gorgias has said that what rhetoric can do is give you freedom for yourself and power over others. And Polus says, basically, so Socrates, you think these orators are flatterers. That means they'd be held in low esteem. But they're not. Polus thinks that orators are held in very high regard. Socrates says, I don't think they're held in any regard at all. What do you mean they're not held in any regard? Don't they have the greatest power in their cities? And Socrates says, no. If by having power, you mean something that's good for the one who has the power. That's what I do mean, says Polus. Socrates says, in that case, I think that orators have the least power of any in the city. And Polus is incredulous. Really? Don't they, like tyrants, put to death anyone they want and confiscate the property and banish from the cities anyone they see fit? And Socrates says, by the dog, Polus, I can't make out one way or the other with each thing you're saying, whether you're saying these things for yourself and revealing your own view or whether you're questioning me. Polus says, I'm questioning you. Very well, my friend. In that case, are you asking me two questions at once? Socrates is a bit of an asshole, okay? And he's sparring with Polus here. Polus wants to make speeches, and Socrates says, no, I don't want to make speeches. I want to have a dialogue here. He's bristling because Polus is, he's not making long speeches, but he's putting words in Socrates' mouth. He's not asking what Socrates thinks. He's trying to tell Socrates what he should think and so forth. And Socrates is getting a bit annoyed. Socrates says, weren't you just now saying something like, don't orators like tyrants put to death anyone they want? Don't they confiscate the property of anyone they see fit? And don't they banish them from their cities? Polus says, yes, I was. And then Socrates says this, in that case, I say that these are two questions, and I'll answer you both of them. I say, Polus, that both orators and tyrants have the least power in their cities, as I was saying just now, for they do just about nothing they want to, though they certainly do whatever they see most fit to do. There's a distinction here that Socrates is advancing between doing what you want and doing what you see fit. And this is very important. Now, freedom in this discussion here really just means power. When we're talking about freedom in this context, we're talking about positive liberty, right? We're talking about the ability to do things. The claim that sophistry will give you freedom for yourself and power over others, that's basically the same thing. Your freedom is measured in terms of power to change things, and that includes power to change other people, power over other people. Freedom is power. And so what's real power, though? Well, real power for Socrates, real freedom for Socrates, is doing what you want. Now, who could disagree with the idea that freedom is doing what you want? Seems pretty straightforward, seems pretty American to me. Freedom is doing what you want. But then Socrates basically assumes here something that comes out later, which is he believes that everybody really wants the same thing. What do we all want? We want well-being. Socrates has a kind of egoistic understanding of human behavior. He says he believes that we're all pursuing well-being for ourselves as we see it. All human action for Socrates aims at the better option for us as we see it. So what we all want is the same thing. We all want the best option for us, which is well-being. And the as we see it proviso is just a recognition of the fact that we're often wrong. We could be mistaken. So we can pursue certain things because we think they will be conducive to well-being, but we're wrong about that. But still, we all want the same thing, which is well-being. Some of us get it, some of us don't, because some of us know what it is, and some of us are ignorant and looking for well-being in the wrong places. But we're all searching for the same thing. And to have real power and real freedom is to get what we really want, and what we really want is well-being. So what's the distinction between doing what we want to do and doing whatever we see fit to do? Well, it's basically the distinction between getting what we really want, namely well-being, and getting something else that we think is going to make us happy. It's going to make us better off, but we're mistaken. Liberalism in the modern sense, both liberalism of the left and right, liberalism of the classical liberal tradition, they understand liberty in terms of doing what you see fit. And they bristle at the idea that you're not free unless you all will the good, the right. Who are you to tell us what's right? Are you trying to force morality down our throats? They're always worrying about things going down their throats. I guess it's like medicine. They think morality is like medicine. And it's a not bad Socratic analogy. And sometimes you've got to force little kids to take their medicine, even though it tastes bad. But they don't want to be force-fed morals. They're adults and they're going to make their own mistakes. They're going to do it themselves. This is what's called negative liberty. It's basically just freedom from external restraints, the ability to do as you see fit, consistent with the ability of other people to do as they see fit. And nobody can tell you what the right use of your liberty is. And if people start talking that way, they're going to take your freedom away and make you an unhappy person. The idea of positive liberty, which means the power to do what you really want to do, which is to be happy, is regarded as a threat to negative liberty. Why? It's regarded as a threat to people who wish to cling to doing whatever they see fit, because they want to do it, damn it. It's their freedom, and you don't have any right to tell them what to do. Socrates says, no, I beg to differ. I have the right to tell you what to do. Wise people have the right to tell you what to do. If you are free by doing what you really want to do, which is to be happy, to attain well-being for yourself, and by doing what you see fit to do, you've gotten yourself in a terrible situation where you're addicted to drugs or alcohol. You don't have any friends and family who will pay, who want to have anything to do with you. And you cling to your false path and your temporary pleasures You cling to the confectionery, in the form of alcohol or drugs, while the rest of your life crumbles. You're not really free. You're actually a slave. You're a slave to your passions. And it is possible by drying you out, taking away the bottle, taking away your crutch, forcing you to dry out, it's actually possible to force you to be free. Force you to put aside the things that are preventing you from doing what you really want to do because you mistake these distractions and dead ends as the path to well-being. And so Socrates is giving the foundation for an idea of liberty, which is consistent with paternalism, state paternalism, and is not consistent with bugger all, let them all make their own mistakes, libertarianism. And this is a very ancient debate, and this is the earliest document laying out the two sides of this debate. And this is why reading Plato is so important. It's so eye-opening. This is the beginning of so much that we're still dealing with in the present. So let's move a little bit forward. Socrates makes some very nice statements here. So let me find a passage. This is Stephanus number 468c. Polus says, well, wait a second here. What about tyrants? Don't they get what they want? They have all the power that they want. Don't they get whatever they want? And Socrates says, no, tyrants don't actually get what they want. And so this conversation is very interesting. Socrates says, we don't simply want to slaughter people or exile them from their cities and confiscate their property as such. We want to do these things if they are beneficial, but if they're harmful, we don't. For we want the things that are good, as you agree, and we don't want those that are neither good nor bad, nor those that are bad, right? And Paulus says, yes, I agree with that. And Socrates says, okay, since we're in agreement about that, then if a person who's a tyrant or an orator puts somebody to death or exiles him or confiscates his property because he supposes that doing so is better for himself when it actually is worse, this person, I take it, is doing what he sees fit. And Polus says, yes. And is he also doing what he wants if these things are actually bad? If you're doing bad things, you're not really doing what you want. If you really want to do the good, that's what he's saying. And Polus says, all right, I don't think he's doing what he wants. Can such a man possibly have great power in that city if, in fact, great power is, as you agree, something good? Paulus says he can't. And so a little further on, where it's 469b, they talk about, okay, what about the victims of the tyrants? The tyrants are miserable people, but what about the people that they do injustice to? So at 469b, Socrates says, the one who puts someone to death unjustly is miserable, he says. But the one who does so justly isn't to be envied. Okay, so what he's saying is look, the executioner is never to be envied, even when he does justice. It's dirty work. But somebody who puts somebody to death unjustly is miserable and pitiful besides. Okay, it's not enviable to be the headman, but it's miserable and pitiful to be doing it unjustly, right? A just execution still isn't a great enviable thing, but it is just. Okay, and then Polus says, surely the one who's put to death unjustly is the one who's both to be pitied and miserable. And then Socrates says something quite surprising. He says, he's less to be pitied, less miserable than the one putting him to death, Polus, and less than the one who's justly put to death. Basically, Socrates is saying, it is better to have injustice done to you than to do injustice. And Polus thinks, how can this be, Socrates? And he says, because doing what's unjust is actually the worst thing there is. doing injustice is worse than suffering injustice. And Polis is incredulous. He says, really? Is that the worst? Isn't suffering what's unjust still worse? And Socrates says, no, not in the least. Now, this is a very important teaching, and this is the third big philosophical topic that is introduced in the conversation with Polis. ABC and Friedrich have written in. Friedrich writes in with $10. Thank you for these wonderful lectures. All the best. Well, thank you very much. And ABC writes in with $10. Thank you. We have the techne, knack, pairs, legislation, sophistry, justice, rhetoric, gymnastics, cosmetics, healthy eating, pastry baking, virtue, flattery, or virtue signaling. Can we then conclude that in our days, the distinction between techne and knack is lost? War, hardship can fix this. What else? Well, here's the thing. The distinction between techne and a knack, what I would say is this. The most important distinction here is between edification and pandering, not between the techne and a knack. You can have a full-blown techne and still be an absolutely shameless panderer. And that's even more dangerous than a bumbling empiric who's also a shameless panderer, when you think about it. There's a possibility here that Socrates is not delineating, which is the use of full-blown technique for the absolute worst forms of pandering. That's really the kind of society that we live in today. If only we were ruled by bumbling empirics, right? But we're actually ruled by fearsomely articulate and technically competent masters of their various crafts and arts, various techniques. They're morally imbecilic, but they're fearsomely competent and articulate, and therefore they're even more dangerous. So in our days, the distinction between technique and knack is lost. Well, maybe, I'm not sure what you're saying there. I think there's a worse possibility, which is, again, that we're ruled by people who are resolutely pandering, and yet they're not pandering from the weakness of being mere empirics and quacks. They're pandering with the full force of science, technique on their side. But that's an interesting issue, so thank you very much for that. Let's move forward. This idea that doing injustice is always worse than suffering it is a hard thing to take. A lot of people just can't stomach it. It seems very namby-pamby. It seems very unrealistic. But we have to go back to the chart, if you will. Let's go back to the chart. The chart talks about the soul and the body. And the moral battle here is with the soul. It's about the soul. Politics produces spiritual well-being through legislation and justice. And counterfeit politics, namely sophistry, oratory, they produce spiritual corruption. When injustice takes place, injustice resides in your soul. Virtue and vice are dispositions of the soul. Evil isn't something that you can just do and slough off. Evil is a capacity that exists within you, and evil acts produce evil habits, and then they fossilize into vices, and they completely warp your entire perception of the world. The right option appears to you as horrifying, and evil appears irresistibly attractive. So you can't just slough off evil acts. You can't just say, ah, well, I'm just going to skate by. it's not some kind of karmic, I'll put it this way. There are all these ideas that you can somehow evade karma. right? You can slip out of karma. You can avoid the consequences of your acts. You can fob off the consequences on other people, fob them off on a scapegoat. Well, that's a very magical idea, and it's a very appealing idea if you're up to no good. This won't go down on my permanent record. Well, Socrates says, I'm afraid it does. The permanent record of your acts is ultimately not stored at the National Security Agency headquarters somewhere, or at Google or Facebook, or you know, the deep state. Your permanent record is inscribed on your soul. And doing bad things produces bad habits and produces bad character and warps your whole perception of reality. And so, if you do bad things, you become a bad person. Now, it's possible for a basically good person to do a bad thing out of momentary, you know, passion or negligence or accident or whatever, right? That is a conceivable concept. But even in those cases, it still goes on your permanent record. There's a distinction between doing a bad thing and having bad character, but it's a distinction that doesn't hold up for very long. So if you do evil, if you do injustice, it marks you. What about suffering evil? What about suffering injustice? If somebody does something unjust to you, does that mark you permanently? Does that make you a bad person? Does it turn you into a monster? Well, it can, but you would have to consent to it. There are a lot of people who undergo misfortune and bounce back, and there are other people who undergo misfortune and they just sink into bitterness, and it poisons their soul. They can't get beyond it. But we do have some power here to avoid this. And so if somebody does injustice to you, they are doing harm to themselves. They're doing harm to their soul. They can do harm to your body. They can take away your bank account and so forth. They can beat you up. They can do all kinds of things. They can even kill you. But they can't make you into a bad person. They can't make you into a monster unless you consent to that. And because of this, Socrates says, it is worse to do injustice than to have injustice done to you. Now, that doesn't mean that you should rejoice at being kicked around or having sand kicked in your face. It's you don't gain virtue by suffering. This is not Christianity here. This is a whole world different than Christianity. There is no virtue in weakness. There is no virtue in suffering. There's no magic in suffering. You're not imitating Jesus on the cross by suffering or anything like that. But by suffering injustice, you're not being morally deformed as a human being. You might lose a leg. You might lose an eye. You might lose your friends, lose your job, lose your bank account. But as a human being, you are not made into a monster. But the person who does injustice to you is harming himself, and he's harming himself in a more fundamental way. Therefore, it is always better to suffer injustice than to do it. But of course, Socrates says, look, given the choice, I'd rather not suffer at all. I'd rather not suffer injustice at all, obviously. But if I were forced to suffer injustice or to do it, I would choose to suffer it rather than to do it. A lot of people have a very hard time accepting that argument. So let's look at things in the text. So we go back to tyranny here. Basically, at 470, page 470, Polus says, well, let's look at a couple of the great villains of our time, the great tyrants of our time. At 470d, Polus says, surely, Socrates, we don't need to refer to ancient history to refute you. Why? Current events quite suffice to do that and to prove that many people who behave unjustly are happy. What sort of events are these? Can you picture this man, Archelaus, the son of Perdiccas, ruling in Macedonia, I take it? Socrates says, well, if I can't picture him, I do hear things about him. Do you think he's happy or miserable? Polus obviously thinks that this guy who's achieved the throne of Macedon through all kinds of villainy has to be happy because he can do anything he wants. He can do everything that he sees fit. And Socrates says, I don't know if he's happy or miserable, Polus. I haven't met the man yet. He'd have to meet the man. He'd have to get up close and he'd have to see how things stand with his soul. Not just the persona that he puts out to the world. You'd have to be able to get close enough and spend enough time with him to get a glimpse under the mask and to see how he's doing. But given his behavior, Socrates doesn't think it's very likely that the man is going to be a happy man. Polus says, really? You'd know this if you had met him, but without that, you don't know straight off that he's happy? No, I certainly don't, by Zeus. It's obvious, Socrates, that you won't even claim to know that the great king is happy. The great king is the king of Persia, the most powerful man in the world at their time. If power means freedom, and that should lead to happiness because you can do whatever you want, the great king should be happy. Socrates says, yes, and that would be true. Meaning, yes, I don't claim to know the great king is happy, for I don't know how he stands in regard to education and justice. And Polus says, really? Is happiness determined entirely by that? Socrates says, yes, Polus, so I say anyway. I say that the admirable and good person, man or woman, is happy, but the one who's unjust and wicked is miserable. So on your reasoning, this man Archelaus is miserable. Yes, my friend, if he is in fact unjust. Why, of course he's unjust. And then Polus reels off all of his evils that brought him to the throne. And Socrates says, well, he might be able to do whatever he wants, but he's not happy because and he doesn't have the power to do what he deeply wants. He just has the power to do whatever he sees fit. If he has the power to do what he really wants, he'd be a happy man. And we would see that by the fact that he wouldn't be committing flagrant injustices. And so we, at this point, we get into the philosophy of punishment. And one of our readers actually wrote to me, and I'm going to read the passage that he sent, the comment that he sent. ABC wrote this. This is a short paragraph, part of Polus's discourse, from an unremarkable translation I found on the internet. What do you mean if a man is detected in an unjust attempt to make himself a tyrant? And when detected, is racked, mutilated, has his eyes burned out, and after having all sorts of great injuries inflicted upon him, and having seen his wife and children suffer the like, is at last impaled or tarred or burned alive, will he be happier than if he escapes and becomes a tyrant and continues all through life doing what he likes and holding the reins of government, the envy and admiration both of citizens and strangers? Is that the paradox which, as you say, cannot be refuted? And the comment here is, I don't understand how Socrates can argue against Polus's argument here unless you define happiness as a quality of an eternal soul completely independent of the physical body. I consider Polus's argument irrefutable and Socrates's argument untenable if we assume even the slightest connection between the well-being of the soul and the body. Okay, good thoughts, good comment. I want to defend Socrates here, though. Now, Polus is laying it on a bit thick. Let's find this passage in the translation I'm using. Okay, so this is at 473c. Take a man who's caught doing something unjust, plotting to set himself up as tyrant. Okay. And Socrates responds to this. This time you're spooking me, Polus, instead of refuting me. Just before you were arguing by testimony, still refresh my memory on a small point. If the man plots to set himself up as tyrant unjustly, you said. Yes, I did. And Socrates says, in that case, neither of them will ever be the happier one, neither the one who gains tyrannical power unjustly, nor the one who pays what is due, for of the two miserable people, one could not be happier than the other. But the one who avoids getting caught and becomes a tyrant is the more miserable one. What's this, Polus? You're laughing? Is this now some further style of refutation, to laugh when somebody makes a point instead of refuting him? I love this. So Socrates is saying yes to this, which is remarkable. He's saying, yes, a man is better off being stopped from being a tyrant than being a tyrant. Now, that sounds pretty shocking, especially Polus lays it on thick with the eye gouging and the burning and the torments on his wife and family. Now, you can say that these sorts of punishments are themselves unjust, and they might be unjust. And this guy's clearly going to be miserable either way. But Socrates is going to say he's been stopped from doing injustice. And if he's being punished unjustly, if the punishment is a bit excessive, well, that's going to hurt his body, but it's not going to hurt his soul. Having his eyes gouged out and being tarred and burned alive or whatever, that's got to hurt. Ouch, right? But that won't make him a bad person in and of itself, whereas getting away with tyranny will. And so, yeah, in a way, Socrates is willing to go on and say, this is, even in this case, it's better for this guy to suffer injustice. And let's just say outright that the punishment is far in excess of the crime. It's cruel and unusual. So they're doing injustice to him. They're tormenting him. And even worse, they're doing injustice to other people, his family. They're not being made worse people by it. They're being made dead people by it, but they're not being made worse people by it. And that's sort of a hard thing to accept. It's possible to be killed, but in the process, not to be spiritually mutilated, if you will. And it doesn't necessarily presuppose that your soul survives the body. Either it does or it doesn't. Either death is full stop or there's a next phase. But in either case, if you're killed unjustly, you're not made into a moral leper or a cripple or a monster. Whereas if you get away with injustice and you spend, you know, a long period of time as a tyrant, you will become worse and worse as a human being. You will become more and more miserable and corrupt. So it's better to stop being a tyrant than to get away with it. And if when you're stopped, you're treated unjustly, well, that, again, it's better to be treated unjustly than to do injustice. So Socrates is going to defend that. And I don't think it presupposes any kind of post-mortem prospects for the soul or an excessively dualistic understanding of the soul. But let's get more into punishment here. Let's talk about punishment. And let's talk about just punishment. Socrates has a penology here that's very interesting. Now, there are various theories of punishment, right? We can talk about deterrence. If deterrence is your justification for punishment, then the death penalty should be the penalty for every crime. It'd certainly be the best deterrent. No more shoplifting, no more double parking, no more saying that you sent the thing in the mail, the check is in the mail when it's not, right? If death is the punishment for everything, that really deters. Other forms of punishment are, you know, ideas of punishment are things like restitution. You can just talk about vengeance, it makes people feel better, or you can talk about rehabilitation. Socrates has basically a rehabilitative model of punishment. It's a kind of medical model of punishment. And that goes back to the chart, right? Always back to the chart. If you look on the chart, justice is analogous to medicine. Justice for the soul is like medicine for the body. So let's say that a person is doing unjust things. They have, well, let's say that somebody has installed himself by various crimes as a tyrant, and he has been overthrown, and he is being put on trial for his crimes. And his crimes include murders and rapes and other things like that. His soul has been sickened. It's been corrupted. And is it possible for his soul to be purged of this corruption? That would be the idea of medicine, or as justice or punishment as a kind of medicine of the soul. Now, a tyrant might be so corrupt that the only way that you could improve the guy is just to kill him, right? Maybe euthanasia is part of the medicine of the soul, namely execution is part of the medicine of the soul. Just like euthanasia might be in the doctor's bag of tricks, not a very pleasant thought. But let's say that euthanasia is one of the things that doctors do, and execution, capital punishment, is one of the things that a rehabilitative model of punishment allows. You could have other less vicious, less corrupt people than dictators, obviously, who might just need some kind of rehabilitation. Somebody who is, I don't know, a reckless driver, a pickpocket, a drunk, something like that. They might be caught, they've got a bad character, but they might be able to be rehabilitated, forced to do honest things, forced to make amends for their crimes. Maybe that will make them a better person. And so Socrates is going to go with a very much of a medical rehabilitative model of punishment here. Socrates says at 478d, of two people, each of whom has something bad in either body or soul, which is the more miserable one? The one who is treated and gets rid of the bad thing, or the one who doesn't but keeps it? And Polus says, well, the one who isn't treated, it seems to me. Now, wasn't paying what's due getting rid of the worst thing there is, corruption? It was. Yes, because such justice makes people self-controlled, I take it, and more just. It proves to be a treatment against corruption. Yes. And then Socrates says, the happiest man then is the one who doesn't have any badness in his soul, now that this has been shown to be the most serious kind of badness. And Polus says, that's clear. And second, I suppose, the second happiest man is the man who gets rid of any badness in his soul. And Polus says, evidently. And Socrates says, this is the man who gets lectured and lashed, the one who pays what is due. Yes. Socrates says, the man who keeps it then, the corruption in his soul, and who doesn't get rid of it, is the one whose life is the worst. Apparently. And so he's really saying that the ones who get away with their crimes are worse off than the ones who are punished. Punished justly. But he would even go so far as to say that it's better to be punished unjustly than to get away with crime, right? Because again, being a victim of injustice doesn't make you a bad person. And being a victim of an unjust punishment would at least stop your crime spree, right? But let's just talk about just punishment. If you are punished justly, that improves your soul. It purges away some kind of sickness, if that's even possible. And the question, I guess, becomes, is that possible? Can we really rehabilitate people? Honestly, I don't know. Honestly, I'm something of a skeptic and a pessimist on this particular matter. I think you can probably rehabilitate people if you get them young enough and you work really hard at it and they're not all that bad to begin with. But honestly, I don't think you can rehabilitate people who are just moral imbeciles or bestial people. And the vast majority of criminals, the criminals running amok, burning buildings and cars in France today, I wonder what level of moral personality these people even possess. There are a lot of people in the world who are sub-moral agents. Aristotle in his Ethics actually has a category of the bestial, people who are just two-legged beasts. They are not moral agents. You can't even say they have vices, and it's hard to figure out what to do with them. I don't know if you can rehabilitate people who are just complete moral imbeciles or beasts. So yeah, that's an interesting question. Socrates might be accused of being excessively optimistic here, or you know, he's basically thinking about the people that he knew. Athenians at the peak of Athenian civilization, people who were on average probably smarter than we are today by 10 or 15 IQ points, given all the dysgenics that's taken place. People who were probably more capable of self-control and virtue than we are today. He was dealing with a higher average. He was dealing with people with very advanced senses of shame. These are the kinds of people you could probably rehabilitate if they don't do terrible things. But tyrants and dictators and just moral imbeciles of the lowest order, those sorts of people probably can't be rehabilitated. It just seems very, very unlikely to me. And so he brings this around now to oratory at the end, because of course, Polus is an orator, he's a rhetorician. And so he's argued that, and Polus agrees, Polus has come around to agreeing that you're better off getting caught and getting punished justly, or even unjustly, than having a life of crime, a successful life of crime. And that's pretty impressive feat on Socrates's part. Because, of course, remember, Polus is the guy who starts out with saying, oh, it's bad taste not to be a cynical man of the world. Socrates says, if all that we've talked about here is true, Polus, this is at 480a, what is the great use of oratory? For on the basis of what we're agreed on now, what a man should guard himself against most of all is doing what's unjust, knowing that he will have trouble enough if he does. Isn't that so? Yes, that's right. Oratory, recall, is the stuff that produces fake justice, injustice cloaked with justice. So what good is oratory if the most important thing is making sure that your soul is just? Well, oratory is a mortal threat. It's a spiritual threat, because it produces counterfeits of justice, which are real injustices. It doesn't produce actual justice. It doesn't produce actual punishments. It doesn't actually improve people at all. Again, let me read this. If these things are true, then, Polus, what is the great use of oratory? For on the basis of what we're agreed on now, what a man should guard himself against most of all is doing what's unjust, knowing that he will have trouble enough if he does. Isn't that so? Yes, that's right. And if he or anyone else he cares about acts unjustly, he should voluntarily go to the place where he'll pay his due as soon as possible. He should go to the judge as though he were going to a doctor, anxious that the disease of injustice shouldn't be protracted and cause his soul to fester incurably. What else can we say, Polus, if our previous statements really stand? Aren't these statements necessarily consistent with our earlier ones in only this way? Well, yes, Socrates, what else are we to say? So let me just make an aside here. I hope that nobody out there who's listening to this, especially my American friends, nobody out there who has, say, run a red light, not paid their parking fines, not paid their taxes or something like that, gets it in their head, oh my goodness, I've got to go to the American criminal justice system and get the evils purged out of my soul. Because let me tell you, I don't think any criminal justice systems in the world, much less the American one, are really concerned with purging the evil out of your soul. And if you are eaten up with guilt over some bad thing that you've done, confessing it to the law is an instinct a lot of people have. They think, I'll finally get past this, I'll get purged of this. But these people aren't interested in justice. And their ideas of justice are often perverse, and they're not going to try and make your soul better. They'll just clap you in prison, where you will be worse off spiritually and physically. So don't get any goofy ideas about going and throwing yourself on the mercy of the American court system, thinking, as Socrates says, that you're going to the judge as though you're going to a doctor, anxious that the disease of injustice shouldn't be protracted. You're not going to get cured for your spiritual ills, your morbid conscience and your self-persecution by the justice system. There's got to be some other way you can square this with your conscience besides going to the justice system. But if we had an ideal justice system like the one that Socrates is envisioning, yes, you would rush to the judge like you would rush to a doctor for medicine once you're sick. Socrates says, so if oratory is used to defend injustice, Polus, one's own or that of one's relatives, companions, or children, or that of one's country when it acts unjustly, it is of no use to us at all unless one takes it to be useful for the opposite purpose, that he should accuse himself first and foremost, and then to his family and anyone else dear to him who happens to behave unjustly at the time. And he should not keep his wrongdoing hidden, but bring it out into the open so that he may pay his due and get well. But compel himself and the others not to play the coward, but to grit his teeth and present him with grace and courage as to a doctor for cauterization and surgery, pursuing what's good and admirable without taking any account of the pain. And if this unjust behavior merits flogging, he should present himself to be whipped. And if it merits imprisonment, to be imprisoned, if a fine to pay it, if exile to be exiled, and if execution to be executed, he should be his own chief accuser and the accuser of other members of his family and use his oratory for the purposes of getting rid of the worst thing there is, injustice, as the unjust acts are being exposed. Are we to affirm or deny this, Polus? And Polus says, I think these statements are absurd, Socrates, though no doubt you think they agree with those expressed earlier. And Socrates says, then either we should abandon those or else these necessarily follow. Yes, that's how it is. And Socrates continues, and on the other hand, to reverse the case, suppose a man had to harm somebody, an enemy or anybody at all, provided that he didn't suffer anything unjust from this enemy himself. For this is something to be on guard against. If the enemy did something unjust against another person, then our man should see to it in every way, both in what he does and what he says, that his enemy does not go to the judge and pay his due. And if he does go, he should scheme to get his enemy off without paying what's due. Basically, he's saying, look, the worst possible thing is to get away with injustice. And if you want to harm somebody, the best thing you could do to harm them is help them escape from justice, right? And he's pouring it on. And poor Polus, again, I think this is absurd, Socrates. He goes on in this vein. If his crimes merit the death penalty, he should scheme to keep him from being executed, preferably never to die at all, but to live forever in corruption. But failing that, to have him live as long as possible in that condition. Yes, this is the sort of thing I think oratory is useful for, Polus, since for the person who has no intention of behaving unjustly, it doesn't seem to me to have much use, if in fact it has any use at all, since its usefulness hasn't in any way become apparent so far. And at this point, Callicles begins the conversation. And he turns to Chaerephon Tell me, Chaerephon, is Socrates in earnest about this, or is he joking? And Chaerephon says, I think he's in dead earnest about this, Callicles. There's nothing like asking him, though. And that begins their conversation, which we will deal with next time. The main points in this conversation with Polus are, first, this very useful chart, which you should memorize, which I think is very, very important. It lays out how Socrates sees things, lays out what produces good health in the soul and the body, and shows how he believes that sophistry is connected with promoting bad health of the body. It's pandering versus edification in the political realm, and therefore it's profoundly destructive. The discussion of liberty, I think, is profound and important, and it will come up again and again in the history of Western philosophy. What is freedom? Is freedom doing whatever you choose to do? Or is freedom doing what you really want to do? Socrates believes that we all want the good life, and he thinks that what makes a good life is an objective fact. It's not all subjective. Why does he believe it's an objective fact, not all subjective? Well, if what makes us happiness, what gives us happiness, what gives us well-being is subjective, that means that we can make up whatever rules we want for the game of life. And if we can make up the rules of life in the pursuit of happiness, we would have to be complete imbeciles not to be happy, right? If you make up the rules of the game and you can make up the rules as you go along and you can make sure that you win by being happy and you're not happy, well, you're an idiot. That's the only possible explanation. If it's all subjective, if you get to legislate yourself what will make you happy. The more plausible explanation for why so many people are happy or unhappy, I should say, is that they're looking for happiness in the wrong place, meaning that it's not subjective. Again, if it's subjective, we'd all be happy because we'd have to be complete idiots to fail if we can rig the rules so we always win, right? The fact is that many people, most people lose in the game of life. Most people are unhappy, even though they desperately want to be happy. Why are so many people unhappy if they want to be happy? Because there are objective facts about happiness that they are overlooking. They're pursuing happiness in the wrong way. So if you're all pursuing happiness and it's an objective fact and some of us are failing, that's because we're using our freedom badly. We're choosing badly. We're making the wrong choices and we are getting in trouble and we're not getting what we really want. And making a fetish out of freedom just makes it worse. One of my favorite memes, this is classic now. This is back 2011, I think I first saw it. It was a picture of Kaiser Wilhelm looking very Prussian. And it said, "You are miserable because you are free." I adapted that to pictures of blue-haired feminists. They're all at Countercurrents. You are miserable because you are free. There are a lot of people who are absolutely miserable because they are so free to mess up their lives and nobody steps in and stops them. Why? Well, because we and society generally, especially the people who've messed up their lives, make such a fetish out of freedom that we don't want to step in and stop them. But if there are objective facts about how to attain well-being, and that's what we really want, isn't being forced to stop doing stupid and self-destructive things actually a way of becoming freer in the real substantive sense of freedom? Socrates would say, absolutely yes. And there's a whole tradition in political philosophy arguing for positive freedom. Freedom isn't doing whatever you feel like. Freedom is doing what you really want to do, which is the right thing. that's a profound idea. It comes from this text first, and we're still debating these issues today. Then there's the question of whether it's better to do injustice or to suffer injustice. Socrates argues it's better to suffer injustice than to do it because injustice affects the soul. If you do it, but not if you suffer it. If you suffer injustice, it doesn't necessarily make you a bad person unless you consent to it, unless you allow yourself to become embittered and destroyed by it. However, if you do injustice, there's no way that you can avoid marking your own soul in some way and making you worse off than your victim. That's very counterintuitive when you see victims living in shacks by the side of the road while vicious gangsters and dictators drive around in fancy cars and go to parties and jet around and hang out with hoes and smoke expensive cigars and, the whole gangster lifestyle. You think that's counterintuitive. You think these guys are living it up. But actually, the longer they go on, the worse they become. And they would be better off if somebody stopped them. They'd be even better off if somebody stopped them unjustly. That's the paradox there. Now, as for punishment, especially just punishment, if punishment is understood as Socrates does, as the medicine of the soul, as a way of purging away corruption, then punishment is not only something we should seek out, it's something that we have a right to. We should be able to demand our punishment, and we should say that, damn it, our rights are being denied if we're not given the proper moral purgation necessary to restore the health of our souls. Just think about that in the context of a society where what percentage of people are taking SSRIs and other drugs because they're miserably unhappy. Obviously, that's not working. Socrates really does believe in not just the right to pursue happiness, as the Declaration of Independence puts it, but the right to happiness, the right to well-being. We have a right to well-being, and that means we have a right to good government, including purgation of our corruption to make us better off. It's an extraordinary alternative to the system we have today. And it's put forward here, I think, with great elegance. The distinctions here are absolutely fundamental. They're very crisply laid out. Yes, there's a lot of back and forth. Sometimes it can get tedious, but I think it's put forward with great clarity and crispness. And I think that before you even make an argument, the greater intelligence, if you will, the greater insight, the greater battle in philosophy is just seeing important distinctions, clarifying distinctions. Life is full of confusion. Things are often muddled. And if you can get clear, crisp distinctions, like the distinction between doing what you want, what you really want, and doing what you merely see fit, that's profoundly clarifying. Just wrapping your mind around the distinction is enough. You might not end up taking Socrates' side in this, but the issue is put forward with enormous clarity here. And it's put forward with this clarity for the first time in the history of Western thought. So let's talk about what we're going to do next time. Basically, 60% of the dialogue is with Callicles. And we're devoting 60% of the class to it, 3 out of 5 sessions. What a coincidence, right? So anyway, we should start reading for next week. And we won't have as much reading for next week as we did for this week. We'll be reading from 481b, these are the Stephanus numbers in the margin, to 494b. So 14 pages in Stephanus, as opposed to 21 for this last one. So just go, keep going through it. the conversation with Callicles is very lively. Callicles is very eloquent, as you'd expect from this hive, this nest of rhetoricians that Socrates is in. And he's Nietzsche 2,000 years before Nietzsche was born. He is an advocate of cynical power politics. He's utterly shameless when it comes to what he considers to be conventional pieties, conventional morals. And yet we're going to discover that there's something truly philosophical about Callicles. He's very unconventional, but his willingness to dispense it entirely with convention is in the name of nature. And he's very, very close to understanding a notion of right that's based on nature. And that's what Socrates begins to hone in on their long conversation. So let's just continue on with the Gorgias for next week, and we'll begin our discussion of Callicles. So thank you all for listening in. Thank you for your questions and comments and donations. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.